on the seaside for display in the Senate. It was said that Fulvia, a longtime enemy of Cicero's for her own reasons, first spit on the head, forcing open the mouth and piercing the tongue with a hairpin. In the end, 2,000 prominent Romans lay dead, including nearly a third of the Senate. The triumvirs found themselves unopposed in Rome, at the command of 43 legions, and broke, the proscriptions having proved less profitable than anticipated. 10 months later, the armies of Cassius and Brutus met those of Antony and Octavian near Philippi, on a broad plain in eastern Macedonia. Two battles ensued, of unprecedented scale and dire import. One side offered to lead Rome toward autocracy. The other fought still for a republic. All was complicated by the fact that the forces were well seasoned and similarly trained. It was difficult for either to achieve supremacy over an enemy that spoke the same language, shared the same tactics, and had submitted to identical training. The two armies of more than 100,000 men met in fierce face-to-face combat amid choking clouds of dust, with drawn swords and bare hands, over the crash of shields, shouts of exhaustion and terrible groans, and ultimately with horrific casualties on both sides. Only after a second engagement did Octavian and Antony, their men on the brink of starvation, prevail over the Republicans. Cassius committed suicide, dispatching himself with the same dagger he had sunk into Caesar. Brutus threw himself upon his sword. The victors approached his corpse differently. Antony removed his expensive purple cloak and laid it carefully over the body to be buried with his brilliant former colleague. Shortly thereafter, Octavian arrived on the scene. He ordered Brutus's head severed from the body and displayed in Rome. Footnote: it was lost en route. End of footnote. Philippi was still a battle of ideas. In its wake, liberty and democracy could be said to have fallen, Caesar's death to have been avenged. Antony now shaved the beard he had grown in mourning. No issue divided Mark Antony and Octavian, who would have to invent one. They were two men in search of a conflict. Across the Mediterranean, Cleopatra, managing domestic crises of her own, would have been within her rights to wonder why the Romans did not subscribe to the tidier monarchical model, given the bloodshed their personal ambitions had over the previous years cost them. As Dio observed later, democracy sounded very well and good, but its results are seen not to agree at all with its title. Monarchy, on the contrary, has an unpleasant sound, but is a most practical form of government to live under. For it is easier to find a single excellent man than many of them. Again in 42, Antony and Octavian divided the Mediterranean world between them, this time shunting Lepidus aside. With signed agreements in hand, they parted ways. Antony emerged in his glory, very much the senior member of the partnership. The military victory had been his. He took from Philippi a reputation for invincibility, one that would inspire terror for years to come. He headed east to restore order and raise funds. Octavian had spent the better part of the month sick, carted about the battle site on a litter. He headed west to regain his health. He was to demobilize the army and distribute lands to the veterans, paid only at the end of a campaign. The world was now in the hands of two men who got on as well as any with diametrically opposed interests and radically different dispositions. One of them ruthless, calculating, patient, the other sentimental, simple, impulsive, which is to say that civil war would rage for the rest of Cleopatra's lifetime. Had it not, we are unlikely ever to have heard of the last queen of Egypt, who stepped into a role that, in part thanks to Cicero, seemed scripted for her in advance. Chapter 6. We must often shift the sails when we wish to arrive in port. Yet what difference does it make whether the women rule or the rulers are ruled by women? The result is the same. Aristotle. Even after Delius's visit, even after the specific instructions, Cleopatra stalled. She had ample reason to do so. The situation was volatile, the stakes immense. Having adroitly maneuvered her way through years of reckless Roman infighting and backstabbing, she had no intention of making a false step now. Delius had not pressed for explanations, but she owed them all the same. She had remained above the fray when the Caesareans needed her. She had issued no declarations of neutrality. Intentionally or not, she had backed her lover's murderer. She had little choice but to offer an accounting. As a client queen, as a friend and ally of Rome, she also had little choice but to cultivate and mollify Mark Antony. While she may well have preferred to steer clear of him, she had a perfectly good idea what he wanted. Antony controlled the East. Egypt fell under his purview. He was, moreover, the much lauded hero of Philippi, where he had seemed uncannily to have been everywhere and accomplished everything at once. As he and his legions had made their way across Asia, he was greeted by adoring crowds in Athens, as a god in Ephesus. At 42, curly-haired and square-jawed, he was still a chiseled, broad-shouldered paragon of rude health. He installed himself in Tarsus, the flourishing administrative capital of Cilicia, near the southeastern coast of modern Turkey. To that lush plain, encircled by the steep mountains of southern Asia, he summoned Cleopatra. The requests arrived one after the other. She let them pile up. Was she temporizing for effect or engaged in elaborate preparations? She could never be accused of dithering, though at several junctures she did wait purposefully for the air to clear. Presumably, this was one of those moments. Plutarch assures us that she entertained no fears, although they would have been warranted. Others were punished for their lack of cooperation. Instead, he wrote the delay down to strategy. Cleopatra believed Delius's reassuring reports, but had greater faith yet in her own powers. They had now blossomed. Caesar had known her when she was still a girl and inexperienced in affairs, asserts Plutarch, but she was going to visit Antony at the very time when women have most brilliant beauty and are at the acme of intellectual power. As an astute commentator has noted, this puts the height of beauty encouragingly late and the height of intellectual power depressingly early. Cleopatra was not yet 30. With the greatest confidence in herself and in the charms and sorceries of her own person, she headed off, not because she was at last ready or could hesitate no longer, but essentially propelled by scorn. She received many letters from Antony and from his associates, but she took no account of these orders. Ultimately, she sailed, concludes Plutarch, as if in mockery of the Roman. It was late summer. Confident though she may have been, contemptuous though she may have appeared, Cleopatra left nothing in her preparations to chance. It was as if she knew she was playing not only to Mark Antony, but far beyond him as well. Certainly she had heard of the elaborate scenes that had greeted Antony elsewhere. Incense and entertainment had followed him across the continent. In Ephesus, the women of the town had met him dressed as Bacchantes, the men as fauns or satyrs. Singing his Dionysian praises, they had led him into the city, full of ivy-wrapped wands, resonant with pipes and flutes and harps and shouts of acclaim. The invitations poured in. All Asia paid tribute and vied for his favor. From Delius, as from others, Cleopatra would have known she was entering a sort of sweepstakes for Antony's attention. She seemed determined to conjure a display so stunning it would propel Plutarch to Shakespearean heights, as it would elicit from Shakespeare his richest poetry. And she succeeded. In the annals of indelible entrances, the wooden horse into Troy, Christ into Jerusalem, Benjamin Franklin into Philadelphia, Henry IV, Charles Lindbergh, Charles de Gaulle into Paris, Howard Carter into King Tut's tomb, the Beatles onto Ed Sullivan's stage, Cleopatra's alone lifts off the page in iridescent color amid inexhaustible, expensive clouds of incense, a sensational, simultaneous assault on every sense. She must have made the 700-mile trip across the Mediterranean by naval galley, pausing for overnight stays, as she had earlier, along the coast of the Levant. At the mouth of the Cydnus sat a lagoon, in which Cleopatra likely transferred her entourage to a local barge, reconfigured and exquisitely decorated for the trip upriver, probably fewer than 10 miles in antiquity. A fully manned galley would have traveled with 170 rowers. For her purposes, she may have eliminated as many as a third. An escort of supply ships followed behind. She traveled with an elaborate stage set. Often with Cleopatra, there is but a slim convergence between the life and the legend. Tarsus is one of the rare points where the two fully overlap. The Queen of Egypt's presence was always an occasion. Cleopatra saw to it that this was a special one. In a semi-literate world, the imagery mattered. She floated up the bright crystalline river, through the plains, in a blinding explosion of color, sound, and smell. She had no need for magic arts and charms, given her barge with gilded stern and soaring purple sails. This was not the way Romans traveled. As they dipped in and out of the water, silver oars glinted broadly in the sun. Their slap and clatter provided a rhythm section for the orchestra of flutes, pipes, and lyres assembled on deck. Had Cleopatra not already cemented her genius for stage management, she did so now. She herself reclined beneath a gold-spangled canopy, dressed as Venus in a painting, while beautiful young boys like painted cupids stood at her sides and fanned her. Her fairest maids were likewise dressed as sea nymphs and graces, some steering at the rudder, some working at the ropes. Wondrous odors from countless incense offerings diffused themselves along the riverbanks. She outdid even the Homeric inspiration. Word traveled quickly, more quickly than did the fanciful, fragrant vision, which was surely the point. From the start of the journey, a multitude assembled along the bank of the turquoise river to follow Cleopatra's progress. As she floated toward Tarsus proper, the city's population ran out to await the remarkable sight. In the end, Tarsus emptied entirely, so that Antony, who had been conducting business in the sweltering marketplace, found himself sitting quite alone on his tribune. To him Cleopatra sent word, as much a marvel of diplomatic craft as of cosmic staging, that Venus was arrived, to revel with Bacchus, for the good of Asia. It was a very different approach from that of the girl in the hemp sack, though it yielded comparable results. There is no better proof that Cleopatra had the gift of languages and glided easily among them. As Plutarch notes, she was especially fluent in flattery. She manipulated its dialects like an expert. Affecting the same pursuits, the same avocations, interests, and manner of life, the flatterer gradually gets close to his victim and rubs up against him so as to take on his coloring, until he gives him some hold and becomes docile and accustomed to his touch. She could not have better calibrated her approach had she known her audience intimately. It is possible that she and Antony had met years earlier when he had come to Alexandria on the mission that restored her father. She had been 13 at the time. During Caesar's Egyptian stay, Mark Antony had sent an agent to Alexandria on personal business. He was buying a farm from Caesar, a transaction of which Cleopatra may also have known. Very likely, she and Antony had crossed paths in Rome, where they had plenty of business in common. His reputation was, in any event, familiar to her. She knew about his wild youth and his periodically messy adulthood. She knew him to be given to theater, if not melodrama. She knew him to be politically astute only on alternate days of the week, in equal measure ingenious and foolhardy, audacious and reckless. Certainly the spectacle of her arrival confirms that she knew of his tastes. She was among the few in the world who could indulge them. For all the travails of the previous years, she remained the richest person in the Mediterranean. Antony replied to Cleopatra's greeting with a dinner invitation. What happened next was revealing of both parties and the kind of behavior Cicero had deplored in each. Antony was a little too amenable, Cleopatra decidedly high-handed. It was the mark of status to give the first dinner. She insisted that he come to her with whatever friends he desired. Such was the prerogative of her rank. From the start, she seems to have meant to make a point. She did not answer summonses. She delivered them. At once, then, wishing to display his complacency and friendly feelings, Antony obeyed and went, Plutarch manages to tell us, before finding himself so dazzled by the scene before him as to be, even in Greek, at a loss for words. Cleopatra's preparations defied description. Antony thrilled, especially to the elaborate constellations of lights she had strung through the tree branches overhead. They cast a gleaming lace of rectangles and circles over the sultry summer night, creating a spectacle that has seldom been equaled for beauty. It was a scene so stunning that Shakespeare deferred to Plutarch, who had already pulled out all the adjectival stops for him. Surely something curious is afoot when the greatest Elizabethan poet cribs from a straight-backed biographer. Either that evening or on a subsequent one, Cleopatra prepared 12 banquet rooms. She spread 36 couches with rich textiles. Behind them hung purple tapestries, embroidered with glimmering threads. She saw to it that her table was set with golden vessels, elaborately crafted and encrusted with gems. Under the circumstances, it seems likely that she, too, rose to the occasion and draped herself in jewels. Pearls aside, Egyptian taste ran to bright, semi-precious stones: agate, lapis, amethyst, carnelian, garnet, malachite, topaz, set in gold pendants, sinuous, intricately worked bracelets, long dangling earrings. On his arrival, Antony gaped at the extraordinary display. Cleopatra smiled modestly. She had been in a hurry. She would do better next time. She then allowed that all these objects were a gift for him, and invited him to come and dine with her again on the next day, along with his friends and commanders. At meal's end, she sent her guests off with everything they had admired: the textiles, the gem-studded tableware, and the couches as well. Just as quietly, she raised the bar, enough to make the initial banquet look Spartan. Antony returned on his fourth evening to a knee-deep expanse of roses. The florist's bill alone was a talent, or what 6 doctors earned in a year. In the rippling Cilician heat, the perfume must have been intoxicating. At evening's end, the trampled roses alone remained behind. Again, Cleopatra divided the furnishings among her guests. By the end of the week, Antony's men carted home couches, sideboards, and tapestries, as well as a particularly considerate gift on a searing summer night, litters and bearers for the men of high rank, and horses decked out with silver-plated trappings for the majority of them. To facilitate their returns, Cleopatra sent each man off as well with a torch-carrying Ethiopian slave. As much as the splendor of her camp beggared description, the ancients did not stint on their accounts, few of which may actually have done justice to the wonders at hand. In this, Cleopatra was by no means alone. Kings would come often to Antony's doors, and the wives of kings, vying with one another in their gifts and their beauty, would yield up their honor for his pleasure. Cleopatra did so only most lavishly and inventively. For this trip, 6-year-old Caesarion stayed home. Plutarch paid tribute to Cleopatra's irresistible charm and to the persuasion of her discourse, but Appian alone attempted to recreate the conversation of the first Tarsan meetings. How did Cleopatra justify her behavior? She had done nothing to avenge Caesar's death. She had assisted Dolabella, a would-be assassin, and a man on whose account Antony had divorced a wife. Her lack of cooperation had been stunning. She sounded no faltering notes of humility and extended no apologies, offering only a bold recitation of fact. Proudly, she catalogued all she had done for Antony and Octavian. Indeed, she had aided Dolabella. She would have done so more generously yet had the weather complied. She had attempted personally to deliver up a fleet and supplies. Despite repeated threats, she had resisted Cassius's demands. She had not flinched before the ambush she knew lay in wait for her, but had met with the tempest that had shattered her fleet. Only ill health had prevented her from setting out again. By the time she had recovered, Mark Antony was the hero of Philippi. She was unflappable, witty, and, as Antony might have surmised from the masquerade as Venus, entirely blameless. At some point, the two broached the question of money, which to a great extent explained Cleopatra's sumptuous display. It was one way to prove your utility to a man in search of funds. The Roman coffers remained empty. The triumvirs had promised each soldier 500 drachmas, or a twelfth of a talent. They had well above 30 legions in their service. It was more or less incumbent on Caesar's successor, if not on the victor of Philippi, to plan a Parthian campaign, and Antony did so as well. The Parthians had favored the assassins. They were land-hungry and restless. Antony had a humiliating Roman defeat of 53 to avenge. The Roman general who had last ventured beyond the Tigris had not returned. His severed head had wound up as a prop in a Parthian production of Euripides. His 11 legions had been slaughtered. A dazzling military victory would once and for all guarantee Antony's supremacy at home. And whenever a Roman dreamed of Parthia, his thoughts turned inevitably, necessarily, to Cleopatra, the only monarch who could fund such a massive operation. Eventually, Mark Antony reciprocated, inviting Cleopatra to a feast of his own. Unsurprisingly, he was ambitious to surpass her in splendor and elegance. Also unsurprisingly, he was defeated on both counts. Cleopatra would be credited later with addling Antony's judgment, and in one early respect, this may have been true. Most Romans would have known better than to attempt to beat a Ptolemy at the luxury game. Again, Cleopatra proved marvelously supple, more adept than Antony at playing by someone else's rules. As bluff Antony poked fun at himself for his inferior fare, As he disparaged the meagerness and rusticity of his feast, Cleopatra joined in. She was entirely irreverent on his account, a made-to-order companion for a man who went out of his way for a good joke and who laughed at himself every bit as heartily as at others. Cleopatra took to Antony's humor with earthy gusto. Perceiving that his raillery was broad and gross and savored more of the soldier than the courtier, she rejoined in the same taste and fell into it at once, without any sort of reluctance or reserve. Having established herself as a sovereign, having flaunted her wealth, she assumed the role of boon companion. It is unlikely that anyone in her entourage had ever seen this particular Cleopatra before. The ability to molt, instantly and as the situation required, to slide effortlessly from one idiom to another, her irresistible charm, were already well established. Cleopatra was, additionally, fortunate in her circumstances. Whether or not the two enjoyed more than a passing acquaintance, Cleopatra and Mark Antony had a number of things in common. No one else had as much reason to be displeased by Caesar's will or to resent the appearance of his adopted heir. Each held firmly to a shred of the Caesarian mantle. Antony had vouched for Caesarian's divinity in the Senate and begun to conjure with that idiom himself. Cleopatra was not the only one engaging in a cosmic costume drama. Unlike most Romans, Antony had long-time experience with quick-thinking, capable women. His own mother had challenged him to kill her when the two found themselves on opposing sides of a political issue. Antony had no problem entertaining a woman at a political summit or a financial conference, as the meeting in Tarsus plainly was, despite Cleopatra's efforts to transform it into a cult spectacle. Fulvia was wealthy and well-connected, as shrewd and courageous as she was beautiful. For her, Antony had thrown over his long-term mistress, the most popular actress in Rome. Nor was Fulvia one to stay home and spin wool. Rather, she wished to rule a ruler and command a commander. Over the winter, she not only represented Antony's interests in Rome, but meddled ferociously in public affairs, so that neither the Senate nor the people transacted any business contrary to her pleasure. She had gone from senatorial house to senatorial house, door-knocking for her husband. She settled his debts. She would raise 8 legions for him. In his absence the previous year, she had stood in for him politically and militarily, on one occasion evidently donning a suit of armor. Nor did Cleopatra's divine pretensions set Antony's teeth on edge. On his way to Tarsus, he had been hailed, as Cleopatra knew, as the new Dionysus. That god, too, had made a triumphant tour across Asia. Here, Antony not only supplied Cleopatra's cue, but recapitulated a Ptolemaic role. Her family claimed descent from the ecstasy-inducing god of wine. They were devotees of his mystical cult. Cleopatra's father had added the new Dionysus to his title. Her brother had briefly done so as well. A theater of Dionysus adjoined the palace in Alexandria. Caesar had made it his command post in 48. Mark Antony might all the same have thought harder about the identification. While his cult was wildly popular, while he was the preeminent Greek god of the age, Dionysus was a newcomer to the Olympian pantheon, where he remained the odd man out. He was congenial, mischievous, and high-spirited, but with his lush, perfumed curls, trailed languidly behind him a reputation for effeminacy. He was distinctly foreign, and he was the gentlest of the gods. One of Cleopatra's ancestors had invoked his Dionysian pedigree to justify having absented himself from battle. Worst of all, Dionysus dulled the wits of men and empowered women. Had the East gone after Philippi, to Octavian rather than to Antony, Cleopatra would no doubt have adapted, but she would have been at a grave disadvantage. She spoke many languages, some better than others. She could not have asked for a better stage set. Tarsus was surrounded on all sides by craggy, forested mountains, lush with wildflowers. An administrative center, as well as a seat of learning, it was, as its native son, Paul the Apostle, put it a generation later, no mean city. Tarsus was celebrated for its schools of philosophy and oratory. It boasted fine fountains and baths, a splendid library. Through the city ran a swift and cold blue-green river, as crystal clear as the Nile was turbid. On arriving in Tarsus 3 centuries earlier, Alexander the Great had thrown down his arms and hurled himself, streaked with dust and sweat, into the icy waters. He was carried, half-conscious, back to his tent. The recovery took 3 days. Surrounded by rich farmland, famed for its vineyards, Tarsus worshipped the gods of fertility. It was the kind of place where 2 deities, one established, the other aspiring, could feel at home and be set off to advantage. Tarsus was inclined to spectacle and able to facilitate one. It was a city in which you could readily fill a 1-talent flower order, which was to say that while its citizens were newly Roman, its culture remained unabashedly Greek. Faced with the same conundrum as Cleopatra, the Tarsans had celebrated Cassius and Dolabella on their arrivals, only to be brutally mistreated by each man in turn. Cassius had overrun the city, exacting vast sums, forcing the Tarsans to melt temple treasures and to sell women and children, even old men, into slavery. Cosmic spectacles and flower budgets aside, its people enthusiastically embraced Cassius's enemies. Antony released the city from its misery. Cleopatra was in Tarsus only a few weeks, but had no need to stay longer. Her effect on Antony was immediate and electrifying. Footnote. It takes a hard heart to argue that Antony resisted the irresistible Egyptian queen, but it has been done. The great Ronald Syme makes of Cleopatra just another notch on the bedpost, assigning to her a list of more or less interchangeable client queens. In his opinion, there was no infatuation at all. Antony succumbed with goodwill, but did not surrender. And in Syme's view, after the Alexandrian winter of 41, Antony felt for her nothing but indifference. End of footnote. The first on the scene, Plutarch expounds on her Cilician's success and allows her a promotion. While in 48 she was before Caesar a bold coquette, by 41 she hails from the take-no-prisoners school of seduction. Her conversation is beguiling, her presence sparkling, her voice delicious. She makes quick work of Antony. The cooler-blooded Appian also concedes instant defeat. The moment he saw her, Antony lost his head to her like a young man, although he was 46 years old, he marvels. The drama understandably overwhelms the history. It is difficult to trudge soberly through that rustling sea of roses to strain truth, especially political truth, from the lush adjectival overload. We hear more of Antony's conquest than of Caesar's, for the simple reason that the chroniclers were as eager to discourse on one as they were reluctant to discourse on the other. As Antony must appear the lesser man, Cleopatra becomes a more powerful woman. She played in 41 not only to a different audience, but to a different choir. Did the confluence of needs add up to a romance? Surely it added up to an easy rapport. As Plutarch noted of another history-making liaison, it was very much a love affair, and yet it was thought to harmonize well with the matters at hand. Of all the Romans in all the towns in all the empire, Cleopatra had particular reason to cultivate this one. Antony had equal reason to do the same. If it was convenient for Cleopatra to fall in love or in step with the man to whom she essentially answered, it was no less so for Antony to fall in love with the woman who could single-handedly underwrite his military ambitions. His Parthian obsession was a bold stroke of luck for her. We know that Antony pined for Cleopatra months later, though she wound up with all the credit for the affair. As one of her sworn enemies asserted, she did not fall in love with Antony, but brought him to fall in love with her. In the ancient world, too, women schemed while men strategized. There was a great gulf, elemental and eternal, between the adventurer and the adventuress. There was one, too, between virility and promiscuity. Caesar left Cleopatra in Alexandria to sleep with the wife of the king of Mauritania. Antony arrived in Tarsus fresh from an affair with the queen of Cappadocia, the consort of two men of voracious sexual appetite and innumerable sexual conquests. Cleopatra would go down in history as the snare, the delusion, the seductress. Citing her sexual prowess was evidently less discomforting than acknowledging her intellectual gifts. In the same way, it is easier to ascribe her power to magic than to love. We have evidence of neither, but the first can at least be explained. With magic, one forfeits rather than loses the game. So Cleopatra has Antony under her thumb, poised to obey her every wish, not only because of his intimacy with her, as Josephus has it, but also because of being under the influence of drugs. To claim as much is to acknowledge her power, also to insult her intelligence. Whether or not anyone lost his or her head to the other, it is difficult to believe sex failed to figure in the picture early on. Antony and Cleopatra were at the height of their power, reveling amid heady perfume to sweet music under kaleidoscopic lights on steamy summer nights before groaning tables of the finest food and wine in Asia. And while he was unlikely to have been a slave to his love for Cleopatra, as various chroniclers assert, the truth was that wherever Mark Antony went, sexual charm inevitably followed. His tunic tucked high on his rolling hips, he had slept his way across Asia at least once. He was fresh from his liaison with another client queen. Plutarch assigns him an ill name for familiarity with other people's wives. He himself later dated the relationship with Cleopatra from the torrid Tarsan summer. The immediate effects of the meeting were practical. Cleopatra stayed a few weeks and accomplished a great deal. By the time she sailed home, Antony had in hand her list of demands. Given what he had presumably exacted in exchange, they were not outlandish. They reveal that Cleopatra did not feel as secure as she pretended. She was keenly aware that another queen of Egypt waited in the wings. Antony lost no time in simplifying her life. He ordered Arsinoe forcibly removed from the Temple of Artemis. Cleopatra's sister met her end on those marble steps, before the ornate ivory doors that her father had donated to the facade years earlier. She was the last of the four siblings. There would be no further mischief from that quarter. Now Cleopatra had put to death all her kindred, a Roman chronicler sputters, till no one near her in blood remained alive. That was true, although it was also true that Arsinoe had left her sister little choice. Caesar had spared her after the public humiliation in Rome. Arsinoe had conspired against Cleopatra ever since. Isis, too, is merciful yet just, delivering up the wicked to those against whom they plot. And Cleopatra was capable of clemency. Antony called in the high priest of the temple, who had proclaimed Arsinoe queen. The Ephesians were beside themselves and paid a call on Cleopatra to beg for the priest's pardon. She prevailed upon Antony to release him. The priest could recognize no further exiled Ptolemies. He posed no danger now. Antony was not so forgiving with the pretender who had been traveling about Asia, passing himself off as Ptolemy the 13th. As some have suggested, he might well have been. No body had surfaced at the end of the Alexandrian War, after all. He was executed. The rogue naval commander on Cyprus who had supported Cassius against Cleopatra's orders, he may have been in league with Arsinoe, had fled to Syria, where he sought refuge in a temple. He was dragged out and killed. This was the kind of behavior that could suggest a man was besotted. So straight away, concludes Appian, the attention that Antony had until now devoted to every matter was completely blunted, and whatever Cleopatra commanded was done, without consideration of what was right in the eyes of man or God. It was equally the kind of behavior that suggested that Cleopatra had made some material promises between feasts. Nor did Antony deviate entirely from custom. On leaving Cleopatra in 47, Caesar, too, had applied himself to settling provincial affairs, distributing rewards both individually and communally to those who deserved them, and hearing and deciding old disputes. Antony took under his protection those kings that applied to him, making of them firm friends. He established chains of command and raised taxes. The difference lay in what came next. Late in the fall, Antony dispatched his army to various winter quarters. And though provincial affairs remained in disarray, though the Parthians hovered about the Euphrates, aggressively eyeing Syria, Antony headed south to join Cleopatra in Egypt. The 28-year-old who greeted him in Alexandria may or may not have been at the height of her beauty, a moment a woman knows always to be several years behind her. But she was a manifestly more confident Cleopatra, even than the one who had greeted Julius Caesar 7 years earlier. She had traveled abroad and given birth. She ruled unchallenged, and unchallenged had weathered severe political and economic storms. She was a living deity with an irreproachable consort, one who relieved her of the obligation to remarry. She had the support of her people, and presumably their enthusiastic admiration as well. She had involved herself more closely with native Egyptian religious life than any Ptolemaic predecessor. Not coincidentally, we hear her voice for the first time now in Alexandria, entertaining her patron and partner. She is self-assured, authoritative, saucy. In light of what came later, Mark Antony's Egyptian visit was assumed to have been Cleopatra's idea and Cleopatra's doing. Ingeniously, seductively, or magically, she spirited him away. He suffered her to hurry him off to Alexandria, as Plutarch has it. It was, of course, equally possible that Antony invited himself. He was, after all, doing what he was meant to do, reshaping the East and raising money. He could advance no further in his Parthian plans without Egyptian funds. He may have felt this was his best chance of securing the monies that a clever queen had promised, but not yet delivered. Asia had proved poorer than anyone had realized. Egypt was rich. There was legitimate reason to survey a client kingdom, especially one that would prove an ideal base for an eastern campaign. Antony would need a powerful fleet, something Cleopatra could provide. The alternative was forever untangling provincial affairs, which played neither to Antony's strengths nor interests. The administrative details had bored even Cicero. The deputations arrived one after another. Under the circumstances, Antony could only have been eager to travel to one of the few Mediterranean countries not ruled by himself. He had been a gifted schoolboy. He was still, in many ways, a schoolboy. He was also a gifted, straight-thinking strategist. If Cleopatra did not pursue him, he had every reason to pursue her, or at least to proceed agreeably and diplomatically, allowing her to feel as if hers were the upper hand, as he had so graciously done in Tarsus. He had already seen Alexandria, a city that the visitor did not easily forget, one that seemed to have swallowed the whole of Greek culture in one gulp. No one in his right mind would opt to spend the winter anywhere than in its satiny light, despite its January deluges, especially in the first century B.C., especially as the guest of a Ptolemy. Either out of deference to Cleopatra's authority, or to avoid Caesar's mistake, Mark Antony traveled to Egypt without a military escort or the insignia of office, adopting the dress and way of life of an ordinary person. He lived very little like one. Cleopatra labored to provide him with a magnificent reception. She saw to it that he indulged in the sports and diversions of a young man of leisure, and that Alexandrian life answered to its reputation. There are cities in which to spend a fortune and cities in which to make one. Only in the rare great city can one accomplish both. Such was Cleopatra's Alexandria, a scholarly paradise with a quick business pulse and a languorous resort culture, where the Greek penchant for commerce met the Egyptian mania for hospitality, a city of cool raspberry dawns and pearly late afternoons, with the hustle of heterodoxy and the aroma of opportunity thick in the air. Even the people watching was best there. For Antony and Cleopatra, euphoric entertainment followed prodigal feast, in observance of a sort of pact the two made, one they termed the inimitable livers. The members, Plutarch explains, entertained one another daily in turn with an extravagance of expenditure beyond measure or belief. From an odd, under-the-stairs friendship comes an intimate view of Cleopatra's kitchen that winter. A royal cook promises to secret his friend Philotas into the palace to witness the preparations for one of her suppers. He will be astonished by the goings-on. The kitchen is predictably electric with shouting and swearing at cooks, waiters, and wine stewards. Amid the frenzy sit mounds of provisions. 8 wild boars turn on spits. A small army of staff bustles about. Philotas, a young medical student, marvels at the size of the crowd expected for dinner. His friend can only laugh at his naivete. Quite the opposite, he explains. The operation is at once highly precise and entirely imprecise. The guests are not many, only about 12, but everything that is set before them must be at perfection. And if anything was but 1 minute ill-timed, it was spoiled. And, said he, maybe Antony will dine just now, maybe not this hour, maybe he will call for wine, or begin to talk, and will put it off. So that, he continued, it is not one, but many dinners must ready, as it is impossible to guess at his hour. Having overcome his surprise and completed his education, the wide-eyed Philotas went on to become a prominent physician, who told his fabulous tale to a friend, who handed it down to his grandson, who happened to be Plutarch. By all accounts, Mark Antony was an exhausting and expensive house guest. As a younger man, he had headed off on military campaigns with a train of musicians, concubines, and actors in tow. He had, according to Cicero anyway, made of Pompey's former home a pleasure palace, filled with tumblers, dancers, jesters, and drunks. His tastes remained consistent. Cleopatra had her hands full. It is no easy matter to create harmony where there is an opposition of material interest and almost of nature, Cicero had observed years earlier, and Cleopatra's differences from Antony were marked. She worked overtime to accommodate, despite what must have been a multitude of claims on her time. She already had a full-time job. Antony visited Alexandria's golden temples, frequented gymnasiums, attended scholarly discussions, but evinced little interest in Egyptian lore, in the architectural, cultural, or scientific underpinnings of a superior civilization. He could not have helped but visit Alexander's tomb, for which there was a Roman mania. He made a trip to the desert to hunt. Cleopatra may have accompanied him. It was likely that she rode and either owned or sponsored racehorses. There is otherwise no indication that Antony left Lower Egypt or traveled to the sites. He was no Julius Caesar. Instead, amid echoing colonnades and a menagerie of glossy sphinxes, along streets named for his lover's illustrious forebears, between the closely packed limestone houses, he raised juvenile pranks to high art. Cleopatra made herself at all times available and amenable, contributing some fresh delight and charm to Antony's hours of seriousness and mirth. If her days were full, her nights were fuller, though her guest needed little instruction. He was a practiced hand at nocturnal rambles, lavish picnics, disguised reunions. He already knew how to crash a wedding. At no time did Cleopatra let him out of her sight. This, too, was politics of a sort. Her kingdom was well worth a prank. She played at dice with him, drank with him, hunted with him, and watched him as he exercised himself in arms, Plutarch tells us. And when by night he would station himself at the doors or windows of the common folk and scoff at those within, she would go with him on his round of mad follies, wearing the garb of a serving maiden. Antony disguised himself for those excursions as a servant, usually incurring a round of abuse, often blows, before returning, wholly amused with himself, to the palace. His capers went over well in Alexandria, a city that conformed in every way to Antony's inclinations, and that before him dropped its defenses. It was light-hearted and luxury-loving. Antony was all muscle and mirth. He liked nothing so much as to make a woman laugh. From his youth, when he had studied military exercises and oratory abroad, he was an admirer of all things Greek. He spoke in the florid Asiatic style, with less bombast than poetry. A later Roman chided the Alexandrians for their buffoonery. A twang of the harp string, and they were off and running. "You are forever being frivolous and heedless, and you are practically never at a loss for fun-making and enjoyment and laughter." This was not a problem for Antony, at his ease among low-rent entertainments and roving musicians, in the street or at the racetrack. He had, too, an admirable past on which to trade. As a young officer, he had urged clemency at the Egyptian frontier when on his return Cleopatra's father had condemned his disloyal troops to death. Antony had intervened to secure their pardons. He had arranged for a royal burial for Berenice's husband, also against Auletes' wish. The goodwill was not forgotten. The Alexandrians happily embraced Antony and played along with his disguises, by which they were hardly fooled. Like their queen, they joined in his coarse wit and met him on his merry terms. They declared themselves much obliged to him for donning the tragic mask with the Romans, but the comic mask with them. Antony effectively tamed a people that only 7 years earlier had met Caesar with javelins and slingshots, as much a tribute to Cleopatra's firm grasp of power as to Antony's charm. Certainly it was easier to take to a Roman who, unlike Westerners before and since, did not play the superiority card. Antony, moreover, appeared in a square-cut Greek garment rather than a Roman toga. He wore the white leather slippers that could be seen on the feet of every Egyptian priest. He made a very different impression than his red-cloaked commanding officer, whose influence still hung heavily in the air. It enhanced Cleopatra's allure. If Caesar could feel with Cleopatra as if he were cozying up to Alexander the Great, and no Roman ever marched east without the image of Alexander before him, Antony could feel as if he were communing with Caesar as well. Appian has Antony exclusively in the company of Cleopatra, to whom his sojourn in Alexandria was wholly devoted. He sees in her a poor influence. Antony was often disarmed by Cleopatra, subdued by her spells, and persuaded to drop from his hands great undertakings and necessary campaigns, only to roam about and play with her on the seashores. More likely, the opposite was true. And while Cleopatra focused exclusively and intently on her guest, she did so without sacrificing her competitive spirit, her sense of humor, or her agenda. Here are the two on an Alexandrian afternoon, relaxing on the river or on Lake Mareotis in a fishing boat, surrounded by attendants. Mark Antony is frustrated. He commands whole armies, but on this occasion somehow cannot coax a single fish from the teeming, famously fertile Egyptian waters. He is all the more mortified as Cleopatra stands beside him. Romance or no, to prove so incompetent in her presence is a torture. Antony does what any self-respecting angler would. Secretly, he orders his servants to dive into the water and fasten a series of pre-caught fish to his hook. One after another, he reels these catches in, a little too triumphantly, a little too regularly. He is an impulsive man with something to prove, never particularly good at limits. Cleopatra rarely misses a trick, and does not miss this one. She feigns admiration. Her lover is a most dexterous man. Later that afternoon, she sings his praises to her friends, whom she invites to witness his prowess for themselves. A great fleet accordingly heads out the following day. At its outset, Cleopatra issues a few furtive orders of her own. Antony puts out his line to instantaneous results. He senses a great weight and reels in his catch to peals of laughter. From the Nile, he extracts a salted, imported Black Sea herring. Cleopatra profits from the ruse to prove her superior wit. Antony was not the only one who felt compelled to impress, but also to remind her lover deftly, firmly, sweetly, of his greater responsibilities. She is no scold, having instead mastered the formula for which every parent, coach, and chief executive searches. She has ambition, and no trouble encouraging the same in others. "Leave the fishing rod, General, to us," Cleopatra admonishes before the assembled company. "Your prey," she reminds Antony, "are cities, kingdoms, and continents." An expertly mixed cocktail of flattery, one that answered perfectly to Plutarch's definition. For such a rebuke as this is just like the bites of a lecherous woman. It tickles and provokes and pleases even while it pains you. If Cleopatra treated Antony like a schoolboy on holiday, that was precisely how he appeared in Rome, to which he turned his back over these convivial months. He celebrated his 43rd birthday in Alexandria, and yet distinguished himself mostly for his capers and caprices. Ironic, given that his original charge against Octavian was that he was a mere boy. Few accusations stung a Roman more deeply. This one so riled Octavian that he would pass a law prohibiting anyone from referring to him as such. Where Cleopatra failed to urge Antony toward his public responsibilities, dire dispatches that arrived at the end of the winter did. From the east came word that the Parthians were causing a commotion. They had invaded Syria, where they had murdered Antony's newly installed governor. From the west came equally disturbing word. Fulvia had created a dangerous diversion. With Antony's brother, she had incited a war against Octavian, in part to lure her husband away from Cleopatra. Having met with defeat, she had fled to Greece. In or just before April, Antony sprang into action, marching overland to meet the Parthians. He got no farther than northern Syria when he received a miserable letter from Fulvia. It left him with little choice but to renounce his offensive and, with a fleet of 200 newly built ships, change course for Greece. Antony had not been unaware of his wife's activities, about which both sides had written him repeatedly. A winter delegation had further expanded on the details. He had evidenced little interest. He was as ill-inclined to reproach his wife as to break with Octavian. Fulvia's disturbances may well have kept her husband in Alexandria every bit as much as did Cleopatra's diversions. Certainly Antony was slow to bestir himself, for which he would be taken to task later. As Appian acidly notes of the repeated and increasingly urgent